Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that lie in the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent investment performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont. Over 90% of software companies are privately owned. But with $75 billion invested in this industry, there is one organization that stands above others. And my guest today founded and built Vista Equity Partners. This success has not only propelled him to become the wealthiest African-American of his generation and to be named by Forbes as one of the 100 greatest living business minds, but in addition to have become one of the most generous philanthropists of his time and managing to squeeze into his schedule the chair of Carnegie Hall and chair of the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Foundation. So to talk about Vista Equity Partners, the world of software and technology, I'm delighted to have Robert Smith, founder and chairman. Well, Robert, I think you're in Houston as we speak, and I'm in Devon, and that's about as dissimilar two places you can get. It's like analog meets digital, and I know which one I am. So I've done a lot of research because anybody who ever worked with me would know that my technological skills were the worst side of appalling. And so this is going to be enlightening to our audience and particularly to me. But let's go back to the beginning, to Denver, Colorado. How did your upbringing shape you?
Sure. And I appreciate you asking that question because, like all things, it comes back to the community. And I was raised in what I call a beloved community. The community was, frankly, a segregated community, all African-American. There was one Japanese family that lived in our community. And we were a community of teachers and Pullman porters and dentists and carpenters and people who own small businesses. And I always felt, frankly, a community that was looking out for me, the children in the community. And that is part of what informed my way of thinking about how life should be. It was at a time when they started busing children across town to desegregate the schools. And all of our parents worked for the most part. And you were a couple that maybe got home a little earlier, et cetera. And so when the kids came home, we would all kind of gather in the houses or the basements where the parents were home early or their jobs got them home early, and the community, in essence, took care of us. And the older kids would tutor the younger kids before their parents came home, and we'd kind of go back to our own homes. And so for me, that was just a wonderful expression of what a community felt like. I saw my parents both being very active in the way that they manage everything from the local YMCA to the Civic Association to my mother donating $25 a month, basically for over 50 years, to the United Negro College Fund. So I just saw a way that a community should operate, and people felt safe and they prospered and were really seeking the American dream.
And I read that your mother took you to that march on Washington and you heard the great Martin Luther King delivered his I Have a Dream speech. And I don't know how young you were, but just tell me, what was it like being an African-American child?
Yeah, as a child, again, I was a toddler and my mother took my brother and I there. So I don't recall being there outside of the discussions at the dinner table for, frankly, years and decades about the impact of standing up for one's rights, civil rights, and doing all you can to continue to educate and build up the station of the community. So growing up African-American, our community was a very tight-knit one, but we've dealt with racism all along the way. And the tragedy of seeing family members and uncles who were slain. One of my uncles was slain at a gas station because he had gotten his master's degree. He had gone to, was working for the state, was actually on one of his job missions, and he was driving his car, had a state credit card to get gas, got gas, and the gas station attendant thought that an African-American shouldn't have a state credit card, so it must be stolen, so he shot him and killed him. And I just couldn't believe that that was the sort of reaction that people would have for a highly educated African-American man at the time. So those are the things that shape you. You have to just continue to lean forward and lean forward to try to change the society that you work in. So that's the dynamic that we lived in every day and to some extent live in today, making as much progress as possible and trying not to have any of the progress get eroded.
So you are obviously a smart student at school. I read somewhere that before you'd even got to university, you applied for an intern at Bell Labs. You had the no, but that was not a deterrent. What exactly happened?
Sure. And this kind of, I call it, was part of my passion for internships, which is something I support at scale in the U.S. Like you and I, we were really, frankly, digital immigrants. We grew up in more an analog world. Computers were introduced somewhere along the life for us. I got introduced to me when I was a junior in high school. My teacher kind of expressed, here's what these computers do, et cetera. I said, well, who invented this thing? Who developed it? And he told him this place called Bell Labs. I found that there was one in Colorado. I called them and asked the human resources person if they had internships. She, of course, said yes. I said, great. She said, if you're between your junior and senior year in college. I said, well, I'm a junior in high school. I'm taking AP classes, getting A's in them. So it's just like being in college. She, of course, said no. I literally called her every day for 2 weeks. She stopped taking a call after the second day. And then for 5 months, I called her every Monday and left a message. And this was that time before voicemail and all that sort of stuff. So 5 months later, she called back, said a student from MIT didn't show up for the internship program. They have another slot. Would I be interested in coming to apply? And I had one suit and a 69 Plymouth Satellite, and I drove out and got the job and frankly worked there the next few years throughout my college career. And that just exposed me to a world of technology that had I not seen it, who knows what I would have become. But that's why internships are so important at young ages for the youth of, frankly, America and the youth of the world.
But you study chemical engineering, which is quite specific. Just help me understand that.
My mentor at Bell Laboratories was a chemical engineer. His undergraduate was a chemical engineer. He was engineering. He was a PhD in solid state physics. We shared an office. We spent literally between 8 and 12 hours a day together when I was there. And during my breaks at school, I'd go back and work. And as he taught me, he said, you are becoming the chemical engineers of the modern day alchemists. We would take one form of matter and transform it into another. We would take sand and make a silicon wafer, or we could take oil and make plastic. And so this is the thing we learned in that discipline. And so that's why I was so focused on becoming a chemical engineer. I look at today, some of the new modern day alchemists are frankly software programmers, where you actually are now able to take intellectual property, an idea, and transform it in the world of code to actually develop an expression of it that can propagate across the entire planet in literally seconds. The world of technological alchemy is, I'll call it alive and well, but it's a learned craft, a learned science. And the chemical engineers were dominating that space for so many years, but now I see to a great extent a lot of the software programming creates a lot of those same sort of elements and impact and ROI in the communities and in the companies in which they impact in the industries that they apply their trade, shall we say.
And I'm intrigued because Goodyear, Air Products, Kraft, you worked for them all before you went back to get an MBA. And what did you learn from those very well-respected firms?
Sure. Again, I was focused on applied research and development. How do you transform one element to another, earned a couple of U.S. European patents and developed a number of trade secrets that were used and in some cases still used for a number of those companies. And part of it is you start to think about how do you decouple bigger problems into smaller elements and then create processes. The thing about those businesses, they are process industries. These are not industries where you build one thing one time. But what you're actually doing is creating a process so you can develop and deliver over years and decades a consistent product with a consistent outcome using, in some cases, inconsistent inputs. Part of what you're doing is developing processes that dampen, and I'll use those words, kind of dampen the effects of the inputs. The other thing that was probably most significant is that was when we were just starting to introduce computing into the industrial environment. In that case, they were programmable logic controllers where we would take a process that was manually administered and managed by operators where they would be watching the temperature or rates or pressure or flows. And as the inputs would be consistent, you'd have to make adjustments. And through those adjustments, you try to get a more consistent output. So you have, call it, a big wave of changes in a process. Well, when you introduce computing dynamics into it, you can make those adjustments much quicker based on smaller rates of input changes. And so you go from these big swings of control to very narrow bands, and the more efficient it becomes more of a straight line. Well, everything that was under that curve is now waste. And if you eliminate waste, you eliminate cost, you eliminate inefficiencies, and often increase productivity. And so that is the effect that you saw of introducing computing power into the industrial environment. Well, that same dynamic started to occur in the late 90s, where we were not introducing, because computing power became more affordable, started introducing it into the business environment. So everything from work that was being done by clerical workers to high efficiency processing of transactions now become digitized. So if you think about it, the big leap is when you introduce computing power into almost any environment, the efficacy that comes from that environment can be captured and realized in various forms in the output. And so in essence, that's the framing of what I learned in the industrial environment that got then applied to the what I'll call the office environment, which is what enterprise software in essence does.
So a cynic would say you go and get your MBA from Columbia, and then with all the certainty that surrounds engineering, you join investment banking that is, shall we say, at times it's made up on the hoof. Tell me a little bit about why, even if it was Goldman's you were joining.
Yeah, you would know that. So, and it was kind of interesting when I really started to evaluate that world of investment banking. And as you know, it's broad, it's fixed income. In some cases, it's mergers and acquisitions, it's financing, et cetera. The efficacy of capital utilization, in some cases, it is very efficient. And in some cases, it's a little more art form applied to it. And when I looked at the world of mergers and acquisitions in particular, I saw that what it did was it actually created massive levels of efficiency because you're combining assets. In many cases, it's really at the highest level of the capital structure. It's a CEO, it's a board level decision. And then it's really taking out costs in many cases and then expanding market opportunity if you do it well. So that's why I thought that was an interesting trade to go and become an expert in. And in that process, really started to evaluate and understand that there are very few software companies that actually were participating in that in the way that industrial companies were doing at the time. Well, it's not surprising. It was a young industry. There were very few companies out there who were doing it at scale well. And this is in the early 90s. Well, what happens is computing power gets distributed more. People are starting to start up more businesses or getting more capital to flow. And so still, and you started off a bit of this conversation, still 98% of software companies are private. You can just start them up at a lower cost than 20 years ago. You don't have to buy big servers and server rooms and air condition them. You basically get a credit card and call Andy Jassy and a few other folks out there at AWS or Microsoft and say, hey, I need some processing power, and you pay for it by the month. And you can develop applications that actually can then develop and reduce costs in an area or provide some service to group of customers that might find some value in it. So that's the dynamic that I saw that said, you know what, many of these software companies, the thing that's interesting is they actually don't know how to run well. Whoever taught them how to run well, you can't go to college and learn how to run a software company. You can go learn how to write code or human resources manager, but putting all those components together. So what we do with Vista is actually build, and we've built a whole set of best practices. When you think about it, it's an engineered approach to value creation in software businesses. And that has been our unique advantage in this marketplace.
Yeah. So for our listeners, 9 years at Goldman's, you set up Vista Partners. I think it was Bill Gates who said software is the magic thing whose importance only goes up over time. Easy now, but it wasn't so easy then. We were on the cusp of the dot-com bust. What was it that you saw that was missing from the competitive landscape?
Yeah, most people didn't understand that software, in essence, it is still the most productive tool introduced in our business economy in the last 50 years and likely will be for the next 50. I do a survey every year of all of our portfolio companies, which number 70 plus at this point. And the ROI of the products that we sell to our customers is still over 600%. There aren't many investments in the world that even approach a third of that. You implement enterprise software in a transaction environment, in a real estate transaction, whatever it is, and the efficiency or small to medium businesses, 600% on average. So that tells you there's going to be, to the extent it becomes more available as software computing power, the consumption is going to continue to increase. That's the dynamic. The other piece that a lot of people didn't realize is once you are using one of those solutions and you've trained your teams and 1,000-person organizations or even 30-person organizations, you're loath to move it from one to another. So it is a very sticky solution set. And I like to tease the early days at Bell Labs, I noticed something. We would sell products to our customers that required maintenance and upgrades because they're changing platforms and making it better. And they pay you to continue to upgrade their product. Well, that was the fundamental premise behind it, is there's these software licenses and maintenance. We convert to different business models, which are now software as a service, which is known as SaaS. But those are the elements of saying this is a business that's mission critical, business critical, highly sticky, high recurring revenues, high retention rates with your customer base. And so if you do it well, and if you do it at scale, and you have consistent approach to the marketplace, you should give a spectacular risk-adjusted return to any investor in those businesses. Now, all that said, it's not a guarantee. If you don't do those things well, I mean, you're disintermediated, or you can cause some problems if you don't put the right sort of infrastructure around those businesses or cybersecurity or those sort of things, then it can create massive, massive losses in the space. So I don't want to say that it's easy, but those are things that I recognize that others did. And I said, well, let's take a systemic approach to delivering a consistent set of activities to every one of the portfolio companies that helps each of the portfolio companies achieve their optimal potential.
And to put it in context, I read that your company is now the fourth largest software company in the world. You serve something like 200 million users. The scale is almost unimaginable. And Gartner's independent research sees this compound growth rate of this sector continuing well above 20% for the future. You have said that there's the fourth industrial revolution happening to us. Digitization, people use the term loosely. Can you maybe just encapsulate what is happening?
Sure. The basic story is there are three major forces that are changing the industrial and commercial world. The first major force is the accessibility of computing power. When you and I were lads, computing power was housed in universities, it was housed in government entities, and it was housed in very large corporations. That was it. And it took a lot of maintenance and people and capacity to keep these systems up and running. And as we migrated, and you're familiar with Moore's Law, to manufacturing at scale of basically microprocessing capacity, we were also able to migrate to lower cost deployments of computing. And then you went from mainframes to micros to minis to now cloud-based computing to now we have more computing processing power walking around with us in our pockets than we needed to launch spaceships 30 years ago. So the distribution of computing power is one of the major forces that's occurred on the planet. The second is a connectivity to that computing power. We built out with your time and Morgan Stanley building out billions of dollars of connectivity between various computing stations. And I'll say it that, and globally, each of the service providers there have now not just went from voice, but now gone to data, and the data infrastructure is actually more robust and more reliable than often the voice at this point in time. The third thing is what we call the IoT, Internet of Things, these devices that are all connected, these laptops, computers, phones, cameras, all those things now have some computing capacity or enable to become a part of that web. Well, when you look at all of that, you start building applications, application software, you start to see the ROI benefits, the benefits of utilizing more software to actually make your businesses more efficient. So every business on the planet now is saying, how do I become more efficient? The early days of this was really about reducing cost. It was transaction cost, efficiency of time, et cetera. That's what modernized, in essence, Wall Street. The trading platforms on Wall Street were modernized actually by one of our companies, TIBCO. And it's that sort of real-time information systems that people say, wow, this moves a lot faster with a lot more reliability than quote unquote human intervention in that context. And then what has occurred, people have in this age of the pandemic, which has been interesting, realized that it's not just for cost efficiency, but this is how they reach their customers and manage their supply chain and engage with their partners. And so that has created another tailwind of effect. So all that was happening in this fourth industrial revolution, utilizing those three forces, just got accelerated because we all went to work from home and many of us, and as a result of that, had to still keep our systems, our businesses running, had to still contact customers or reach new customers and reach new markets at the same time when there was, call it a stabilization of, call it the network of computing power and connectivity and IoT devices. So many, again, in our business in particular, we've got massive tailwinds across our entire infrastructure, where companies are now saying, I have underinvested in enterprise software, which came to light during this age of the pandemic. And now I've got to reinvest and invest more so that I can either maintain my relationship with my customers and my partners or expand it into markets that I otherwise didn't have reach during this, the age of the pandemic. So it's been a really interesting dynamic over the last 18 months, horrifying in many respects in terms of how horrible this pandemic has affected many communities. And then the other side, what it has brought to light is the reliance of people and companies on software and, frankly, the durability of enterprise software models. So those are the things that have kind of popped out of the pandemic as of late.
And can you maybe give us an illustration of what it is that Vista, with its funds and capital, can do and has done to really turbocharge a business?
Sure. I mean, it crosses many different fronts, from Finastra, which is out in the UK, second, third largest financial services tech company in the world. This is a business that serves almost every major bank on the planet, for the most part, from treasury management, risk management solutions to core management solutions for core banking solutions. And one of the things, just to give you just a quick example and tie it to the pandemic, at the time in the U.S., one of the challenges was in the minority communities, African-American, Latinx communities, 90% of those communities don't have branch banks. They're served by what I call the capillary banking systems with their community development banks or minority depository institutions. And as the U.S. government was moving forward to provide some loan relief in the form of paycheck protection programs, these companies didn't have access to them, the small companies in those communities. Our company, Finastra, got their team on it, their LaserPro team. They did a spectacular job in a short period of time building a solution that interfaced with the Small Business Administration platform, the U.S. government. And they were able, in essence, to now deliver an enterprise software solution to these small banks. And literally in 24 hours, 500 of these small banks downloaded this system and were transacting and were able to deliver now almost 100,000 loans to these 100,000 plus businesses for the Paycheck Protection Program, which saved, literally multiply that by 3 to 5 times number of jobs in those communities. So that's the impact that an enterprise software business can make at the time, in a time and a point of crisis. We actually, with Allocate, delivered to the UK for the defense and maritime sectors and for the NHS, large-scale temporary hospital workforce management solutions. And I think had 800,000 people ultimately being managed in our online solution, which we were able to stand up through a portal that can be used by hospital administrators and workers, et cetera. Those are the sorts of things that enterprise software can do in times of a pandemic, beyond the impact, what I'll call, again, the average ROI of a product that we sell to our customers is almost 600%. It's actually over 625% for our customers that we sell in banking, finance, et cetera, healthcare, automotive. I'm more in 65 different sectors. So that just gives you some instance of what we can do in the near term and some of the things that we support day to day across our portfolio.
And fast forward 10 years, what would be the one or two things that really will be obviously different from the way business is done today?
We will move more into what I'll call a hybrid environment. Things aren't going to return to the way they were in 2019, and they're not going to look like the way they were in 2020. And what that really means is it's going to be a hybrid. It's going to be a hybrid of in-person and those who will call it remote. And we're going to be more seamless in the way that we work, in the way that we interact, in the way that we communicate. We're going to have a higher degree of analytical capacity in evaluating how we work, what we do. There'll be more predictive analysis and predictive activities in our day-to-day work that will enable us to be more efficient in how we do our work. Those things are not just 10 years, they're here now. They're going to accelerate and we are going to become more reliant on this. Even today, you're typing in something and it's giving you corrections and how you should do it, and you're mad at half of the corrections, but over time it gets better and better and better. Well, think about that in all of the work that you're doing, where you're getting assisted in what I'll call in some cases routine, but otherwise exploratory dynamics of work that will actually make us more efficient in what we do. And frankly, I hope that we will take that and use these tools to ensure that our work underlies more sustainable activities in the way that we impact our planet, that we need to be a little more gentle on it. We need to actually kind of recede, roll back some of the damage that we've done to it. and frankly, make a more inclusive planet. One of the advantages of enterprise software and platforms that we've talked about is you can now include more people who may have not had the opportunity, may have the brilliance and the smarts, but just not the opportunity to participate in the economy more efficiently, which I think will stabilize what I'll call some of the other political dynamics that we're all dealing with and wrestling with.
Where are the specific businesses where you think the greatest opportunity for making money exists?
For us, again, 98% of these companies are in the private market. So at a high level, a private market enterprise software is likely still going to be a very, very lucrative space for experts, people who know what they're doing, know how to find these businesses and know what to do with them. In addition, I think about sectors that we invest in that make a ton of sense still. The native cloud-based companies, we think that they provide some risk-return opportunities that are actually still quite attractive. We think that areas in and around hybrid environments are going to be attractive. You're moving from one form of all in-person to hybrid, in addition to teaching and training environments in a remote setting, in addition to what I'll call automated programming. How do you actually make more efficient programming activities? And a lot of that's going to be done through code. So that's how we think about all the overall themes. Of course, there's, you know, fintech, ad tech, all those sort of areas. But that's how we really think about how what the investing environment and landscape looks like us for the next few years.
Just shifting tack slightly, we had Professor Neil Ferguson from Stanford on the show, and we was talking about China's philosophical approach to many things which are antithetical to many in the West. We've got growing cyber risks, and somebody wrote the other day that really the British military budget should be changed almost completely, replacing soldiers with anti-malware and the likes. How do you think about the geopolitical dimension to what you do?
I think everyone has realized the importance that enterprise software will play in the fabric of every industry, every government, and every government's military. And so, not surprisingly, there's thought and energy and activity around that in the offensive and the defensive. Being this optimistic person, I would hope that one day we could come up with some form of a detente where there's just, you know, hey, we are not going to do this to each other. That sticks and stays, because if you continue to have those sort of skirmishes and activity in the cyber world that are state-sponsored, well, obviously, it can lead to some very drastic actions, but frankly, it can lead to more trifurcation of the tech stack, which would actually slow down the growth for everyone. That interoperability dynamic we have all benefited from for the last 30 or 40 years is not something we should take for granted, which I think we are at this point. That interoperability, and you and I are across the planet right now and probably communicating on 3 or 4 different systems, and we don't know that. We can trace it, but we don't know that. But if you think about if it creates interoperable standards and those go away, we might not be able to have these sort of calls because one system might not talk to another. In the old days, we all used to work on multiple spreadsheets, if you recall. And back when you were at Morgan and I was at Goldman, if we were working on a deal together, and we would be on Asterix and you would be on Lotus, and we'd have to have a fight, right, as to which spreadsheet we're going to use. And think about all the waste, and now we kind of all have standardized on one spreadsheet. That's just an example of how much waste we were able to eliminate just through those sort of activities. Well, by having an interoperable set of standards. So it's something that has to really be thought through. And I'm hopeful that leaders of the nations that are kind of in that dynamic understand that the better answer is to continue to drive forward an interoperable standards on the tech stack and figure out detente policies or policies that enable us to actually communicate and move forward as humans on this planet in an efficient way, as opposed to being protectionist. We need to protect our intellectual property. There's no question about that. But we need to actually deliver solutions that protect us all from bad actors, as opposed to creating more consternation in that environment.
So let's talk about the world of private equity versus public equity. I think the statistic is that there are only half the number of public companies in the US that were 30 years ago. A criticism that is leveled at the world of PE sometimes is its short-termism and its willingness to do transactions. How do you think about it? Because I also notice you provide permanent capital to your firms, but how do you weigh up the need to return capital to your investors and at the same time you're trying to manage, in many cases, our secular growth opportunities?
The public markets, because of how they're incentivized, as money managers. I'm not talking about the average retail investor. And the average retail investor is still making their own decisions. But the institutional investors, often they're focused on quarterly results on companies. And you have to ask, what are the cycles of change in a business? In some businesses, the cycles, maybe they should be measured in quarters. And in some businesses, they should be measured over longer periods of time, in most businesses. And the private markets provide the opportunity to what I call engineer the solutions properly for the business for the long term, as opposed to focusing on optimizing some short-term return so that that quarter gets optimized, but it deteriorates what I call the long-term economic rent capture for the business. So that's where the fundamental conflict comes into play. I think the private markets have a greater alignment with the stakeholders, which are employees and the customers, because you have a longer time to get the problems fixed properly or deliver what they really need. And of course, the shareholders, and then ultimately the communities that they serve. All that's an important part of alignment. And I think the private markets typically, in some cases, private markets actually are still too short in the duration. The average private equity firm kind of has 10-year durations in their cycles. We have, as you mentioned, a perennial fund because it's designed to say, look, there are certain businesses and instances that you really don't want to sell these things. You actually want to return capital to your stakeholders through recapitalizations or dividends, or whatever it is, for long periods of time. Why should we be forced to sell them? The business or the cycle and what their market is isn't captured in the framing of the terms of how private equity firms were written. Remember, these terms are 40 years old in many respects. They were built at a time when the businesses that we're in weren't even thought about. So again, it's aligning a business model to the businesses that you actually own, and the enterprise software businesses can lend themselves to longer hold periods relative to other assets.
And who have been your clients? And given the size today, are your clients changing?
We've got over 700 institutional investors in our funds, from public pension plans to sovereign wealth funds to high net worth families to some endowments. So it's across the board. And I continue to see that there is an underexposure for most of those that I just mentioned to our space, our segment, enterprise software. It's the fastest growing. It frankly has some attributes from a returns perspective that are higher than all the other investment segments that are out there. It has the greatest number of three-time return funds than any other segment out there. But yet I see people are still underexposed, even though every single company that they're investing in, the principal way in which they are creating value is embracing more software in their business. And I tell institutional investors all the time, and I say, okay, if you're looking at that sector, just double click one more time in the companies you're investing in and how are they creating their returns? And often it is bringing some efficiency to their operations by bringing in more software. I said, well, that should give you a clue as to what they're relying on to create value in those businesses. So why not just remove that secondary risk of that underlying industry by being in the software that powers that industry? There's no correlation, which is actually interesting, in the returns of the software businesses to the underlying industry and how that underlying industry has done, because it becomes mission critical and business critical. And if that industry is open or those companies are in business, they have to buy the software. One of the interesting things, Simon, that also came out during this pandemic is people stopped paying their bills to pay for their rent, but they paid their software bills. Now, think about that. Our retention rates actually went up. That's when you talk about, okay, what was more reliable and durable as an asset class? And software has clearly emerged in that regard.
Wow, that is interesting. Now, tell me that we've got these major tech platform companies, money's flowed into them, they benefited from the pandemic, and yet they're very big. They're getting regulatory and fiscal scrutiny. Are they in some ways unhelpful for creating optimal competition and new business development?
In some cases, they are. In some cases, they aren't. The thing that I've been having conversations with a number, and this is kind of timely of institutions, is I used to advise a little company 30-some years ago, 28 years ago, called Apple Computer. You probably heard of it. And it was interesting, and it was challenged. It was having a number of issues. There was a period of time where it might have gone bankrupt. And we invited the founder back into the company. One of the main changes that happened is it became from a call it a singularly kind of focused silo to becoming a platform. And what that platform did was created massive amounts of innovation at the peripheral. When you start to invite innovators in to participate on your platform, it created massive growth, not just for that platform, but for all of the people who are contributing. And now if you start to analyze that business, a lot of the revenues, et cetera, come from outside organizations who are now tying into that platform of distribution and opportunity. Those are very healthy ecosystems. You can argue, are they too big, are they too small? I don't know. I'm not going to opine on that. But what it did do is create a massive amount of jobs, massive amount of opportunity, massive amount of capital return to investors. All of those things of liberating these ecosystems and opening the ecosystem should be viewed as the model of why that's important to have them. They have to, of course, be responsible stewards. And I've got great respect for Tim and what he's been doing over there with his management team and hiring people like Lisa Jackson and others from the EPA and saying, we're going to take the lead on other issues like ensuring that we are carbon neutral, carbon negative. Oh, not just at the company, but also for the supply chain, which is very hard to do, but they're taking the lead in that. So there's a lot of goodness that comes out from those ecosystems that should be recognized. And too often, we call it the media and the press focuses on the badness, you know what I mean? And not the overall effect of what these ecosystems provide in terms of opportunity for the advancement, not only of science, technology, but frankly, the communities in which they serve. So that's my view.
Let's switch tack and talk about philanthropy and rebalancing. You've signed the Giving Pledge along with Bill Gates, Warren Buffett. That's giving away half of your wealth while you're alive. We had Sir Chris Hone on the show who's done sort of similarly. I know you're a great believer in capitalism, but there is a but. What's worrying you?
The thing that worries me is we need to continue to support capitalism as a form of improving the human experience. It has been the greatest effect, or it's had the greatest effect on improving the human experience generally. And this is in terms of job creation, in terms of higher quality of healthcare, higher quality of education, has all come through the capitalistic construct. There are very few other constructs out there that have delivered that at size and at scale and at mass that improves the human condition. And it's important that we don't demonize it, but it's also important that capitalists realize that they've got a role to play in the communities they serve. And the beautiful thing is you see business leaders not only just embracing the idea, but embracing it through their actions. We're having real results and people are being held accountable in terms of how they're getting paid and their compensation as a result of their efficacy around it.
You've been terrifically generous. I mean, I just two snapshots. You paid off the debts of the Morehouse graduating students in 2019. In 2015, you sponsored the college education of all the returned Boko Haram girls. Do you find yourself pushing on an open door?
In some cases, yes. In some cases, not as open as you'd like. I learned long ago that you have to do what you feel is right for the communities that you serve. You have to listen to those communities. We have great responsibility when you become a steward of capital and a steward of opportunity to really be thoughtful about it. Not everybody gets everything right. That's the way life is. But part of it is you got to get more right than wrong. and you try to deliver what I call systems at scale that improve the human condition and liberate the human spirit. And that's what I believe in. And I will continue to move at least my life and the organizations I have a chance to touch in that direction.
Well, Dr. Martin Luther King, whose famous quote, the arc of moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. But you have added, I'll quote you, over time, we've learned that the arc doesn't bend on its own. It bends under the collective weight of millions of humans who replace the inertia of our past. And I was talking to a gentleman called Clem Hutton Mills, who's a colleague from Rothschilds and his family come from Ghana. And he posed a really interesting question was, how do we ensure it's secular change and not cyclical, i.e. it's a movement, not a moment?
Through communication. And I will tell you the advantage, not that I'm a hammer and everything is a nail, but the advantage that software and technology has given us is the opportunity to communicate. I have a chance now to communicate with leaders throughout the world every day and ensuring that we are aligned in what we're doing. Yesterday, I was on a call with 8 leaders from African nations talking about how we are going to work to digitize components of their society, because they realize what they want to do is to capture the benefits and not just have their people get smart and leave, but have their people stay and build up robust economies. And they have to make the investments in the physical infrastructure, then the intellectual property infrastructure, which is the training. And then, of course, creating commercial infrastructure for these folks who are trained to now work in their environments, in their countries, as opposed to go get educated someplace else and stay somewhere else. But years ago, you wouldn't have had that conference or conversation unless you all converged in a place. And it would take months and months of planning, and only half the people would be there. Well, today, we can literally within hours, and literally it is that, get on a phone call, get on a Zoom call, get on some platform call, and have these conversations and actually say, okay, now here's what we're going to do next. So that's what I look at. And I say, I think that I've got optimism that we're moving in the right direction.
We were chatting to Philip Bassett, who's a veteran of the UK private equity industry, and he asked a different question, which is, what skills have you learned from the world of private equity that you've been able to put to good effect in philanthropy?
Yeah, leveraging capital. I tell my team and my people at Vista, and we've got over 450 people at Vista and 70,000 employees across all the portfolio companies, I say, look, you should go provide your intention in shaping your communities in the best way that you think that you can. And I say, comma, however, I think it isn't just capital, it's the intellectual property that you understand in organizing resources to make it more effective, which is actually has more impact in many cases than just the capital. And so that's how I think about it. I was on with a senior group yesterday of one of some financial, actually top 200 or so executives, and having some conversations about that. And I said, one of the things we do really, really, really well is organize resources in our companies. So let's take that same as an individual organizational capacity to your communities. And it might be organizing reading groups or coding academies and things that we do like that, which we do as an organization, but even individually, and bring that sort of organizational capacity to the philanthropic world. And I think that can have a higher impact than even some of the capital that is donated.
So I have a few closing questions. What do you wish now that you'd known when you were 20?
Man, there's a lot. I wish that I would have probably spent a little more time kind of understanding other elements of business besides just the technology angles of business. But, you know, as a technologist, that's what I did. And the other parts, engineers are kind of taught that if you come up with the right answer, then that's the right answer, as opposed to starting to understand how other constituencies might look at it. And like all things, you want to make sure things are a little more crisply organized in contracts later than what you found earlier.
And you make, I've listened to a couple of them, inspirational speeches. I always tell my children, a gift of being born into an English-speaking nation is the language. Don't waste it. Did you just acquire that? Or did you actually have to work at becoming so rhetorically capable?
My wife and I kind of joke at it. I said, at the end of the day, I'm really just a shy engineer who likes to get on the whiteboard and solve complex problems with solutions. But I learned, when you grow up African-American in America, you learn you have to communicate in a language that people understand, given the biases they may have through their lens. And so you have to practice and you have to work at it and get a whole lot of no's, and you learn what gives you more of the yeses. And so it's like anything else, you have to practice and get good at the craft, not just solving the problems, but communicating how you're solving those problems.
Now, I know you love fly fishing. Who are the two people, one alive, one no longer alive, who you would love to have met and spend the day in conversation and tranquility by the riverside?
I'll tell you, there are two who aren't here who I would. One is W.E.B. Du Bois, and the other is Frederick Douglass. And I'd like to actually, if I could spend a few days with them together. In fact, I think that would be an uplifting experience for me and kind of frame some things in a way that I'd like to engage in. And in terms of people alive, it's interesting. I've had a great life. Hopefully it goes on for a lot longer, where I get to meet people and spend time and do some fly fishing. There's one person who I haven't spent any time with who I'd like. I spent time with his brother, but Elon Musk. I think I'd like to actually spend a little time with him just to get some framing on how he's thinking about how technology, he works in a different area of technology than I do. And I think that would be a useful conversation for me and hopefully a useful conversation for him.
Well, maybe we can ask him when he comes on the podcast, which he hasn't been invited to yet, but I'm sure that if we get a chance, we'll be inviting him. But if you can take a week away on holiday with your family, where do you want to be?
We enjoy being with each other wherever we are. I like our ranch in Colorado, and frankly, that is a beautiful place to connect. It's a place that connects to my grandmother and our community beyond her generation. And that is a, like all things, it fills the soul.
Well, my final question is, I've listened to you before this interview and I've listened to you today, and I see somebody who has terrific empathy, real life experience, incredible generosity. And I'm just keep on asking myself, why wouldn't you want to run for president?
I like my job today. I have a good job.
Well, I think the US could do with a shy engineer at the top.
Anyway. No, I appreciate that.
Robert, I've taken a lot from this, and we normally summarize with a couple of things, but I certainly didn't know that the bill that people pay above all else is their software bill. So that's going to make me think again. And your journey has been one which has hopefully got a long way to run, and that this software equation is, it may not be at the foothills, but it definitely hasn't reached the summit. So we need to think about that. And you guys are doing some great work. So Robert, thank you again for your time and wish you the very best of luck.
Thank you. All the best to you, Simon. And thank you for inviting me on the program.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.